end of the table. Apparently we ran out of space. We have so many panelists. So I'm on the chair at the end, and that's why I'm wearing my name badge. We apologize for starting a little bit late. Dragon Con and things were running later and later throughout the day, and we, of course, caught the tail end of it being the last panel here of the evening. So to kick things off, we've got some charity stuff we're going to do first. I'll let Mr. Scott Jones, our EFF track director, tell you about that.
Hi, I'm Scott Jones. I'm director of the Electronic Frontier Sports Track here at Dragon Con, and this year our designated charity is the Atlanta Center for Self-Sufficiency. It's a charity for the homeless, and their goal is to be a handout, not a handout. They get up to 72% of the people that come into the program will get into full-time employment, so I think that's pretty good. I want to send this around. There's an information sheet if you want to know more about the charity. We asked if you got some spare change or a dollar or something like that, if you could kick in, we'd appreciate that. So I'm going to send this around. Thanks.
Good cause, good cause. Yay! And now we're going to double dip, and we're going to send a non-charity jug around here. This is our Hacking 201 Pizza Fund, so if you want to join us for pizza, kick in spare change or a buck or whatever you want in here. There is no obligation whatsoever, but the more cash we get, the more pizza we get for everybody. And we're not supposed to have, because this will get Scott in trouble, we're not supposed to have certain liquid refreshments in here. This is kind of a high-profile place. But you'll notice I haven't said anything about the EFF track room, which is Hilton 208-209. We're going to run until about midnight in here, maybe midnight 30, and when the pizzas arrive, we'll have a runner come down and tell us. Then we will all make a mad dash upstairs to the EFF track room to continue with the pizza and any possible surprises that might be in there. Check under your chairs. It might be like an Oprah thing. You've got, and you've got, and you've got. Yeah.
So. No, I didn't see the Fireball Girls yesterday.
Oh, okay. Didn't see it? All right. Still. We're being intentionally vague, and anything, if I say too much, we'll just edit it out and post. Yay, beer. let's see. I guess we've got pretty much reused most of my singing script from last night. Who was here at Hacking 101?
Woo-hoo.
Oh, a lot of people. Cool. I can skip a lot of that bullshit. Yeah. Oh, and by the way, since it's after 10 o'clock and we're not really worried about family-friendly or child-safe, fuck that bullshit. That's all you want.
Fuck!
You're gonna feel like ass tomorrow trying to check out. So let's just have a group primal scream right now. Alright, I'm gonna go ahead and let the panelists introduce themselves briefly. Although you don't have to be as brief and concise as last night, because fuck that shit, we're in here for a while. And then I guess I'll ask the first question of the panelists, and then we'll start taking audience question and answer stuff there. And it'll generate into the usual Hacking 201 bullshit anarchy mayhem, and hopefully it's fun. And I really appreciate all of y'all being here, because you could be elsewhere staring at attractive, scantily clad people, listening to a lot of music, and getting totally drunk. Yeah. So let's start this. Introduce yourself briefly, who you are, what you do, why you're here, and let's work your way downstairs.
My name is Ray Kelly, and I am an application security person. So that includes both web apps and mobile app security. I work at HP as a practice principal. I ran the mobile pen test team for 2 years there, so companies give us our apps, we can go break them for them and tell them the results. And came through HP through the SPI Dynamics acquisition, which so I help write web spec and we does that product. That's it.
Hi, my name is Ilanka Dunan. I've been coming to DragonCon since, I think, 1998 or so. There's also a hacker convention in Nashville called Freaknik, actually founded by Johnny X. It's now an official nonprofit. I am the chairperson of that nonprofit. The next convention will be Freaknik 20, which will be coming up in November of this year. So if anybody would like to come speak at it or attend, definitely let me know. I can hook you up there. My thing is old school crypto. I also kind of got myself into CIA at one point to go see the crypto sculpture. So if you have any questions about famous unsolved codes, I can talk to you about that. Anyone who's heard of Voynich manuscript, I actually have a replica that I made that's up here. I'm also a computer game developer, so if you have smartphones, you've probably got a couple games there with my name in the credits. And other stuff. Okay, next.
Hello, my name is Xavier Ash. I am been hacking since the late 80s, been doing DragonCon since the early 90s, and alumnus of Georgia Tech. Right now I work for a startup called Drawbridge Networks. That's pretty much it.
Hey, I'm Drew. I break shit all the time. No, I run a company called Red Mesa. We do break shit all the time. And we do digital and physical pen testing from simple commercial buildings to TS cleared facilities for the government. I do things with locks. That's why we have locks up here. I will not be picking these locks. I'll just show you how shitty Brinks is. If you work for Brinks, your company makes terrible locks, as well as safes and other things. So I look forward to talking to all of you.
What's going on, guys? My name is Chris Grayson. I am also a Georgia Tech alumnus twice and a research scientist. I am the founder of a network security firm called Website, SIGHT. I work with this guy from time to time. We break into things. And prior to the venture that I'm currently on, I was a penetration tester. So basically, professional breaking into things e-person.
Hello, I'm Chad Ramey. I build things. Currently an undergrad student at Georgia Tech, and I do research there as well. I write code from time to time. I also design, build, and program electronics. I build robots and nuclear things in my garage. I like making things. Talk to me about physical stuff.
Giggity. That wasn't a giggity line.
All right. Quick announcement. I've been reminded at 11 o'clock we're going to do the winners of the EFF Trap Crypto Challenge. So I'll be turning the mic over to the Master of Ceremonies for that. And you may have noticed we had a little bit of a drinking game going during Hacking 101 unofficially. If anyone uses the word cyber, you take a drink. If they use the word startup, you take a drink. If they use the phrase cyber startup, that's 5 drinks.
You're all fucked.
All right. We've also got somebody on the phone with us. If you could bring up Chan Lee slowly, I know there's some noise on it, but let's see if we can get his voice in on this. Hello, Randall, are you there? Can you say something? Chan Lee, bring it up. Okay, hello, Randall, can you hear us? Merlin, can you hear us? Not working. Okay, I'm going to go back and debug this.
All right, we'll keep trying. This is Randall Schwartz, who, due to some unexpected illness, cannot make it to DragonCon this year. He's a regular on the EFF track, and we miss him dearly and hope his health continues to improve and that he will be able to join us next year. Randall Schwartz, if any of you are into Perl or Ruby or Smalltalk, he probably wrote the book that you use to learn that stuff. So, great guy. While we're waiting to see if we can get Randall on the phone, let's see here. Panelists, question number one and only from me, really. As there is no universally agreed upon definition for the term hacking, and at best we seem to have a set of interrelated concepts that people argue over, flip page now, but don't read that part. What does hacking, quote unquote, mean to you? Let's start at the end and work our way down.
I would say that hacking means, the way I look at it, is breaking shit. That's simply put, right? Looking at web applications, the way you get in is you break it. That's usually the easiest way to do it. So I'd simply say it's just breaking shit.
For me, hacking is when you run into something and you can't figure it out. And you just start beating on it with every tool available at your disposal to see if you can just chip away a little bit at it. And then often as you're chipping away, you suddenly find, ooh, squirrel, and you find some little avenue that you go off on a tangent, you learn things that you weren't expecting to learn while you were trying to go at that first problem.
For me, hacking is it's a process in which, you know, I want to learn how it works. So that involves first breaking it open and finding out how it works. The story told in one-on-one, you know, basically I had, you know, as a kid, had a, you know, nice 13-inch little CRT TV that was my little TV in my room, and I wanted, like, you know, surround sound with this thing, but I, you know, was seven, so it didn't really work out for me to go down to Best Buy and pick it up. So I just took the top off and figured out all the wires in the back, finally found, you know, where the sound goes out, split it open. I was able to drill a hole in the side and get me a little, go down to Radio Shack, get me a little plug. And all of a sudden now I had sound that went to my speakers. And it was just mono sound, but it was really loud. So it was awesome. And that's in essence what hacking is. You want to do something to something. You want something that the thing doesn't do. And you want it, and you're going to break it up and figure out how you can break it to make it do what you want it to do.
In 5 years, he will not be able to tell that story because no one will know what a CRT is. yeah, so hacking for me, I'm going to give you the cheesy answer. As someone said, wow, that was a fucking PC answer. I was like, okay, yeah, sure. So hacking is a mindset, I believe. Whether that be digital, analog, outside of computers or hardware or physical logs, hacking can be, you know, with very mechanical items such as engines. Hacking can be, as a lot of people think of hacking with computers, it's an approach that you take to solving a problem or to making something better. Hacking is literally there's nothing broken with it, so I'm gonna fix it. Approach, which means you're just gonna fuck it up.
So, how many people here in your childhood have done something where you followed your parents' rules but they still got pissed off at you? That's basically hacking. Somebody gives you a set of rules that you have to follow, you follow them, and you still manage to do exactly what you wanted to do, despite the fact that those rules were not meant to permit you to do that.
I'm not touching my little sister, I'm not touching her, I'm not touching her.
Precisely that. So basically the idea being you have a system, whether that's physical, whether that's digital, whether that's somebody else you're trying to social engineer, there's a set of rules you have to abide by, and the fact of the matter is you have to follow those rules, but you still want to subvert the system itself. The mentality that is required to fulfill that process is what hacking is at its core, in my opinion.
So I'm gonna piggyback on Drew's answer. I think for myself, hacking is kind of doing things the hard way. So it's taking something apart, dumping the firmware, disassembling it, writing in what you want, reassembling it, JTAGing it, and then you have a piece of hardware that does what you want. It's instead of buying something new or using more parts or buying the proper license, it's making it work when you need it to work, how you need it to work, regardless of what circumstances you find yourself in.
All right, I guess we're gonna try Randall again.
Hey Randall, are you there?
Speak up. One more time. All right, now.
How about now?
Yeah.
Hey, everybody. Hey, everybody.
Can you hear me?
I really wish I could be there with all you guys. I'm really missing out. And I had a little medical emergency, the details of which are probably not relevant in this conversation. But I'll give you the short version. I spent 2 weeks in ICU and 4 weeks in rehab trying to remember how to walk. I seem to have done that though, so.
Yay!
Released me before DragonCon, I would not have been able to walk around very far anyway. I could barely walk about half a block to a block door to sit down for a bit. But I'm getting all that back, most of my lower back, a little bit sore. But you know, the last 16 Dragon Cons, I've only missed two of them, this being one of them. And it really upsets me that I had a break, for having another break here like that. I really hope that I will have no medical emergencies next year, so that'll be a good uptick.
All right, we're going to hold you to that.
Okay, sounds good. The one downside, by the way, I don't want to be a bummer in the room, but it turns out my major medical insurance lapsed about a year ago because of a clerical error, so I'm on the hook for about $300,000 right now.
Can you hack your way out of it?
We've got people.
So we're going to get some revised and updated editions of Learning Pearl? Is that what you're saying?
No, that doesn't pay very well. I've got to find something to do that's going to be income revenue generating over the next few years. What will probably happen is that I'll end up paying about half of that, and then they'll write off the rest, but I'm not guaranteed that. As a comparison, I paid $270,000 for the Intel legal case. So I am capable of doing this. I just need to have the time and energy to do it.
We are rooting for you. You get better.
Yeah, I'm walking out of here. I'm walking out of the rehab center Tuesday morning. I'm going to a hotel for a couple days. Then I'm flying back to Portland, Oregon. I'm in Santa Monica right now. I'm flying back to Portland, Oregon on Thursday, and then I'm going to take some needed time off at my brother's place up in Olympia, Washington, to also deal with the death of our brother back in January, which is, Mom hasn't gotten over either, so it's been a weird year so far.
I was going to say, Randall, you have the rough year. Stop it, okay?
Yeah, I know. If you see me, if any of you see me online looking for some sort of contract work or employment or something, please pass it along, because I've got ZipRecruiter right now providing me 3/4 time, but it'd be nice to have some more clients out there that I can.
I wanted to talk to you while you were here at DragonCon, so I'll hook up with you in a day or so. I think I've got something I can toss your way.
The thing is, I've been quiet for the next gig because, of course, you don't want to miss out your main contractor. But they also might go away at some point, too, so I've got to be looking for the rest of the stuff. One of the things I want to do, by the way, is I've been studying the Dart programming language from Google for like the last year or two or three since it started being on the horizon, at least. And now with the addition of the new operating system, it's named with Flower, operating system, just came out. Anyway, but one of the things it has is a Dart programming software development kit. And so if I can do a full program about Google's new microkernel,
Randall, can you hang on just a second? We're having a technical glitch here. We're going to try mashing a different button and see what happens.
Okay, try again.
Just tap it and tap it again.
Anyway.
There we go.
Okay, so the thing that's that Google just announced, and I wish I could remember, it's the name of a color, like purple or something close to that.
Fuchsia,
yeah. So I'm liking what that looks like, and I may want to be an expert now. Then I could write classes about that, teach, write books and stuff like that. So that might be my next gig. I don't know. We'll see.
I have an idea. Since we don't have any people lining up at the mic yet to ask questions of the panelists, which is kind of how this panel works, people. Would you like to ask the first question of our panelists here?
Well, unfortunately, the audio was so bad, I don't even know who's on the panel. So of course, Johnny X, probably.
Chad's here, Alanka is here, some other folks I just met whose names I can't quite remember, so.
I literally share the same first name as he does.
Yeah, but everyone knows me as Johnny X, sometimes even I forget on the words.
Yeah. Actually, I don't really have any questions, except maybe how do I go back 12 months in time and get my insurance back?
Well, to do that, Pat and Rachel have to get science track an actual budget, and then we can implement time travel.
Awesome. That would be cool.
I think we've got an actual question up here.
In a sense, this is a bit of a two-parter for Drew. One, are you giving away lockpicks for good questions?
Since you're a one-on-one, you actually already know my interests. So my lockpick sets, which I am giving away, some one is dedicated to show me, if you show me and give me your current email password, I will give you a lockpick set. Some lady gave me her phone password yesterday for a lockpick set. So, but now it is your email password. Or your bank account password.
All right. All right. I'll do that if this next part doesn't work.
Does it have to be his, or could it be someone else's, as long as it's
mine? Someone else's, as long as it's not mine. What's your question?
Can I have a set of lockpicks?
That is, so the first rule of social engineering is always to ask, right? And asking works. Yeah. That works once, by the way. I have two more, maybe three to give away, depending if the panelist is gonna keep the lockpicks that he's using.
Before you ask the next question, just I almost forgot here. I've got some really good but really hot as hell popcorn from pyropop.com. It's been donated, so if the panelists think a question is good and you're willing to destroy your taste buds in a very enjoyable way, you're welcome to have a bag of this while we wait for pizza and other refreshments. So what is your question, sir?
I guess I got two questions. Am I close enough?
Yep, you're good.
So does this need to be an email that is like my primary email or just I got a list, I'll give you one.
A Gmail account. Yeah. If you have an Android phone, it has to be your Gmail account. If you have an iPhone, it probably has to be your AOL account because Just kidding. I don't. Or your iCloud account.
Okay, can't give you one of those.
If you have a Windows phone, just don't even bother.
I'm surprised you know what email is.
My actual question, talking about Fuchsia, I've heard some speculation that it's gonna maybe be a Linux drop-in, so Google can sidestep some licensing stuff, or maybe it's a real-time OS so they can use it in their cars, or like so their Android stuff is less shitty and laggy. Do y'all have any speculation on what that might be for?
I don't. Does anyone? No. You stumped us. Congratulations. Maybe you get lockpicks up for that, actually.
Yeah.
We'll do that. Now the next question has to be really, really good to get the lockpicks set.
No pressure. Okay, in recent years, there's been more of a trend to automated testing and automated pen testing and really approaching security from the automated side. And I'm trying to figure out if I can say automated or automated one more time, but really, what's the best approach to saying no, instead of devoting your resources as a company or a product to using a tool, actually changing culture or getting somebody involved in working on this sort of thing?
I'm sure everyone has answers for this, someone else talk because I've talked too much already.
Yeah, I can kind of speak to that. So, like I said, help write WebInspect, which is an automated scanner. And we have a lot of customers that say, well, you know what, you missed something. The scanner didn't get it. Well, it's a tool, right? And you got to take both the tool, which does a good heavy lifting that you don't want to deal with, right? Like mapping landscape of your web app that has thousands of pages to it. But you got to use that along with your smarts, your manual testing as well. So, you know, even us, I hate even telling customers, say, oh yeah, just buy this automated scanner, we'll find all your shit for you. You know, we don't even do that. You know, we say, hey, this helps you with your testing. So it needs to be a combination of both automated and your manual testing as well.
But your question was, how do you convince upper management, right?
I mean, as best as you can.
Yeah.
Get hired Drew once. They're pretty thoroughly convinced. It's somewhat difficult because the difference in cost between what you can run an automated scan for versus what you're getting a legitimate pen test for, and to be clear, there's a difference between a pen test and a legitimate pen test. There's a lot of people, well, a lot of organizations that sell what they call pen tests, which are basically augmented automated scanner results, which is not what I'm referring to. It's expensive, absolutely. But if you get a good pen testing firm in there that does a good job, you put the results of that test side by side with something that's coming out of one of these automated tools, which, to be clear, automated tools are important. They do a lot of cool things. They do not pen test. You put this result side by side, especially from the more talented folks, it will sell itself from there. So the initial buy-in might be a bit difficult, but from there, if you hire the right folks, the buy-in should be a bit easier.
Thanks.
So what automated, or correction, what open source tools do you advise people to start off with?
Very nice. OpenDots.
Oh, open source tools.
OpenDots.
Yeah.
I mean, to get started with what?
Yeah.
Attacking a individual endpoint.
Individual endpoint, what? So a single host?
A Windows 7 endpoint. We'll just go
Windows
with that.
7 endpoint, is it running any network services?
No.
Well, I guess not. So my network services that I...
My first thing then that I would do is if I'm plugging into the network for the very first time, the first thing I like doing is opening up Wireshark in a passive mode and viewing to see what's broadcasting, right? There are plenty of large companies that will install certain software on their endpoint systems, or they'll actually have software on their networking systems that will share tons of information for you, and it does not leave any huge footprint for yourself. But holy shit. Does that work? Oh, let me try it. And then, so then after that, after Wireshark, I'll use something like Nmap, right? And profile the system as best I can there. And then from there, it depends on what I find. But those are the two open source tools that I would recommend when first looking at a system to attack.
I would follow it up with Nmap is really kind of one of your best friends, especially doing the full TCP connections. As far as network pen testing goes, if you're trying to traverse across a network, if you're trying to initially compromise a network, all you're concerned about is what applications are actually sitting there that I can speak to. Nmap is the best tool for identifying that. And dig a bit deeper. There's similar tools like ZMap and MapScan, which can do what Nmap does to a lower depth, but to a greater breadth. So you can scan the entire internet for a single port with ZMap in about 2.5 hours. So things like that. But I'm a big fan of the network scanning software like ZMap, MapScan.
So some of the stuff that I do is work on lateral movement that is silent. And so finding out how to find those services without scanning the network and maybe triggering something is basically, if it's part of an Active Directory domain, you can, there's a thing called SBN. It's a particular type of DNS entry that is a catalog of all the special servers in the Active Directory. And so you can just basically request that type of stuff via a Active Directory LDAP request, and all of a sudden you can not exactly where their exchange servers are and all the web servers and everything, the Active Directory is very happy to tell you exactly how, where it is. So,
it's totally true.
Yeah. Hi, I was wondering, what's the most interesting thing you've found you when hacking something for any company? And why?
I learned about a new type of porn.
Says the guy who used to
to work in the porn industry.
So yeah, the type of porn was a very interesting type of porn, I guess.
It's now this big.
Have you heard of like suspension? People put hooks in their in their backs. Yeah, and then they like to hang. Yeah, so the particular type of porn was girls that would put hooks down on the lower regions, and they would then hang upside down and give guys blowjobs. I didn't even know that fucking existed. And I was quite disturbed, actually, when I found it. I was like, ow?
It's only been downhill ever since, Virginia.
Yeah.
The other one, like, I mean... Not only how interesting, like, how the most interesting thing you found, like, well, that brings up a question. How did you manage to find that? Like, what were you trying to get to the point that you found that? What were you actually doing?
Yeah, so I got onto that system using, it was a Windows XP system, and it had,
Oh,
and
we chased Dad out and his son. We were so sorry about that.
Oh, I'm pardoned about that. I didn't know we have little kids.
No, he was even there.
But yeah, so it was MS-08067 was the exploit, which is a very old one, and it has it just ran Metasploit on it and was able to pop a shell. And from there, I was looking for directories that had sensitive information, and he had a directory called password.
There were no passwords.
Yeah, I was very sad to find that there was no password. But yeah, no, it was, that's how it was. It was just an unpatched system. Found an exploit, or there was already a pre-built exploit for it that was point and click, basically. Got into the system and done. And when we reported that particular problem, we said that we found non-business content on the business system.
That's to give some additional context. In a lot of cases, so the way that pen tests work is you break in initially and you find kind of the attack chain, and then if you have kind of already stolen the family jewels, at that point you switch from trying to compromise things to enumerating vulnerabilities. So then you go into information gathering mode. So my personal experience with finding the most interesting trove of, again, porn, was finding like 2,500 plus very incriminating pictures of the point of contact himself. in this trove of data.
Was this Anthony Weiner?
Any additional information. But basically, yeah, I mean, step one is getting all the way in. Step two is going across and ever finding everything that you can, and then hopefully you don't find
it. Getting all the way down.
All the way in. And, so it's not so much, at least in my experience, you don't usually find very incriminating information in the process of the initial compromise, but once you've gotten that compromise and you're looking for additional vectors to get in through, that's where you find the dirt.
So back when I was early IDS days, I was out there and then put in a POC for just to drop it in, find some stuff, and come back a week later and take a look. And this was, I would say, probably like 2001, 2002. And if you've been in the scene for a while, you might remember a tool called Back Orifice. Dead milkman, right? The back orifice team. They run on port 31337, which is, very awesome. And they were using back orifice, which is, at that point was about 10 years old, as a remote management solution.
Was that the
it was their cover story. Yeah, it was like, and it was really useful back in the day before BNC and all that. But I mean, it was just.
It's free, it worked, you know?
Exactly.
It was probably better supported than the majority of like actual mainstream users.
Yeah, if I can jump in just because you brought back fun tales of discovering interesting porn in interesting places. And when I used to work for Gaylord Entertainment IT, a very prominent Christian music label up in Nashville, Tennessee, and Amy Grant was on, pretty much all the executives there had large stashes of bestiality that we found on the network drives when they filled up the network drives. Yeah. Praise Jesus.
Alright, so I have two questions. First one, I already have lock picks, so can I just borrow one of those locks for the panel to play around with?
Oh, great question. Yes, you may. Do you have lock picks here?
Yes.
Man, this guy came fucking prepared.
So the second question is, for any of the panelists, what exploit or hack caused you the most personal or professional hardship?
Hacks that cause hardship. Hatches cause the bottom. Actually, so there is. Oh man.
Actually, I do have an answer for this.
No, there's a particular IPS system that I'm not thinking of.
Okay. Yeah. So I got sued by a company before. I've actually had legal actions with three companies. They like suing me, I guess. I like breaking their shit. Also, did I tell you Brink sucks? They were one of the companies that has not pursued legal action against me yet. But they can't because they actually do make terrible locks. So I'm not lying. Yeah, so I was giving a talk. I was all excited about this talk, and this company came down on us pretty hard. And I had to nerf my talk quite a bit. I reverse engineered some of their firmware. The attack was I could turn off their alarm systems remotely. So I reverse engineered some of their firmware, and at this time they didn't give out this particular special code that allows you to unlock their system to add some functionality, which actually does protect against other attacks that I then later developed against them. My mistake, as I was told by the EIF, was I bought their product new, and I agreed to their EULA. So buy your products you're gonna hack, use. Oh, before I say this, I'm not a lawyer. buy your products used, and make sure someone else agrees to that EULA and you don't. But yeah, no, that caused a little bit of panic in me. And that's why, hashtag no free bugs anyway. Oh, he's still looking for it. Other hardships. There's a prominent RFID company. I reverse engineered their firmware and posted it online. I then got a letter and got told to stop doing that. What else? I found another O-Day and a product when I was trying to come up with my senior prank. Told the company and they told me to, pound sand, I guess. But like in legalese.
I sold a wireless detection IDS solution product before Cisco built that, and it was to a medical hospital chain, and two or three years later, sitting in one of those hospitals, and I was bored. So I was looking around on the network. They had a wireless network that. I was just seeing what they had, and lo and behold, about 10 minutes later, I get to meet the IT guy that runs that software. Hey, I know so-and-so. He still worked there, so luckily I had a name drop, get out of jail free, but being hacking when you're bored, when you actually sell them good security software is not a good idea.
Any other panelists?
So I haven't found the name of it yet. I'm going to have to reach out to somebody. But there was a particular IPS, or intrusion prevention system, which gave me a lot of grief. And especially, I'm not a very big proponent of defensive appliances that are deployed within corporate firewalls. In a lot of cases, they don't really provide any real defense. But this particular one, once I figure out the name of it, I will announce it. But if you're doing network scanning, which is what we were talking about earlier, which is one of the first things you do to try and establish where you want to go after, this particular system would return false results. So it would tell you that services were open when they weren't. It would give you fingerprint data back that was entirely erroneous. You couldn't even connect to those particular network services. If it determined that you were running a network scan, the way that these network scans work in a lot of cases is they do a TCP full connection, and it would actually hold on to that connection and make it super, super slow. So it would target you. So even basically identifying what network services even resided on a network was very difficult and very time consuming, and we had to actually establish new approaches for finding information that otherwise is taken for granted by a lot of attackers. All
right. You hang on just a minute here. Scott Jones, I believe we've got it's 11 o'clock and we're going to do your EFF Crypto Challenge Awards, am I correct?
Yeah, it's time to announce.
Hold on. Take another question or two.
Oh, okay.
Never mind. Disregard what I said completely. Yes, sir. Your question, please.
Yes, one of you talked about hacking as a mindset, which makes it sound domain independent. So what about hacking into politics? We have very strongly coded politics on the left and on the right, which is very hard to break into. What does the hacker mindset recommend to an activist who wants to break in?
Don't piss off Hillary Clinton.
Don't murder you, man. Again, identify the rules of the system, identify how they work, identify how you can abide by those rules, figure out what your objective is, and then figure out how you can obtain that objective while following the rules with the least steps possible. I mean, that's really the same mentality you can take to approach anything. Politics are particularly slow moving and difficult to break into. But seriously, the core concept of just figure out what the rules are, figure out what you have to abide by, and then be creative and find out how you can use those rules to achieve your goals in the shortest amount of time possible. Four Scout IPS, good lord. It's called Four Scout IPS. That's
the Anyone else?
So I have two questions, if that's okay. The first one is, for someone who already has a lockpicking set but has no clue how to actually use it, can you recommend any resources, preferably free, for learning how to use them?
Yeah, so come to the pizza and beer part of this and I'll show you how to use them.
And also, tools.org, I think they have an extra, I think it's like TOOLS.org.
TOOL.us.
The Open Organization of Lockpickers.
Very careful.
Three L's
and an L. And the second question, specifically for Alanka, can you tell us some more about your copy of the Voynich manuscript?
It's in the news right now that someone's making a replica of the Voynich manuscript. I made my replica several years ago, basically by downloading images from the website of the Yale University Beinecke Rare Book Library, and then spending a lot of time figuring out which page was on the opposite side of which page, and used up a lot of printer toner and scissors and tape and just the whole thing. So I've seen, regarding the most recent article about the company that's making the replica, I'm really interested in seeing it, not enough to spend $8,000 to go see it, but I've seen many people make replicas and they miss a lot of stuff. So I'd be happy, if someone wants to spend several thousand dollars to get a copy of that replica, I'd be happy to proofread it.
Thank you.
All right. So, going the other way, not talking to management, but I work with a newer internet company with a very international development team. And a lot of these developers don't come from necessarily a formal background or really give a shit about what they're doing. And so we see a lot of very, I don't want to say simple, but mistakes that should have been, they should have learned by now not to do. Do you have any references or, I don't want to say examples because there are tons of examples of people getting hacked in the negative connotation, but any sort of good documents or things I can share with them to say, hey guys, this is why it's important to follow best practices, this is why it's important to not be an idiot.
Yeah, so OWASP is a great resource to look up. So they have all a top 10 list of top vulnerabilities for websites. They have a wiki site that'll have examples of how to exploit to do SQL injection, how to do cross-site scripting. And it's a pretty good resource to, it's a great organization.
So, OWASP?
OWASP.org, I believe.
Awesome.
Yeah, I believe that stands for the Open Web Application Security Project. But the, you're kind of touching on a bigger issue here. It's not, yeah, if you teach these particular contractors how to develop their software better, that's great. 6 months from now, the team's going to be different. The software's going to be different. It's still going to be placed within your environment. The problem is still there, and we haven't actually addressed anything. So this actually comes into, this kind of touches on something called threat modeling, which is very important in the security world, which is where if you want to actually secure something, the first thing you have to ask yourself is what are you securing it from? Is it the NSA that you're trying to secure it from? Well, good luck. Yeah, have fun with that. Is it potential script kiddies that are just trying to break into your application and steal stuff? Okay, that's one thing. But once you actually identify who you're trying to secure your infrastructure or products or software from, then you can start talking about the defensive controls you need to put in place. This problem of outsourcing software development to third parties that don't have sufficient security background is not going away, as far as I can tell. So, going back to threat modeling, if you actually want to prevent the, or basically help mitigate the risk posed to you by this problem, then you now need to assume that your network has been compromised. How do you protect your sensitive resources? Those applications will always be vulnerable. They will always be poppable. How do you prevent somebody that is able to compromise those assets from further compromising what you care more about?
So, and I'll give a little bit more corporate answer. You know, it's like if corporations want to buy products to fix problems, and I know that everybody up here, you know, will just moan at that, but that's, you know, the kind of reality of it. Especially buying box, right? You know, put a box in there and fix it. You know, for securing web applications, it's really kind of before and after. And the before is, you know, products like, you know, Ray's worked on, and you know, and being able to what is it, kind of like, right? Dynamic and static, and
it's just dynamic.
Just dynamic. So you basically to look at your code, you know, as you're writing it, and if you say, you know, that's a open-ended buffer there, that's not a good thing to do, and you fix it. That goes in before, you know, you go out and publish it. And then there's the after, which is going in and scanning it and being able to produce, you know, more realistic, you know, estimations on, you know, here's how attackers can do it. So, and so generally he's talking about a static, you know, the security looking at the code versus dynamic, which is after the code has been written, I'm actually going to use a software very good. That's the banding. He's got the right answer, right? And I give you the perfect.
Cool. Thank you.
And I would add one more quick note that if you think web apps are bad right now that people don't know, mobile apps. If your company has mobile apps, that industry is a disaster right now. Those developers, there's very little knowledge of security with mobile apps. And now it's even worse because they're so easy to make, right? Throw a drag and drop that Cordova, PhoneGap, Xamarin. Dude, I'm making a mobile app. I'm just gonna drop this stuff in. 2 weeks, my app's done. You know, the back end's just an API. Google's not gonna index it, so I don't need to test it for any web app. It's not a web app, it's an API. I don't need to test it for security. and those get rained all the time.
I really do my best not to think about that.
Yeah, so mobile apps.
You should definitely think about it. It's a problem.
I know it needs to be rewritten. That's the problem. Like, it doesn't matter. It's in the backlog.
Mobile apps are the new frontier. It's like where web apps were in the year 2000. That's where mobile is right now. And just the knowledge is non-existent, and they don't care. They're pressure from management. Hey, we got to get to market now. I heard you can write an app just by, you know, throwing some things together and shove it up out there. And so mobile's really bad right now.
That's not a problem for the anti-consumer.
Right.
We call that job security up here.
Thank you.
Hey, this.
Okay, no, not yet. Now we're ready. Sorry, just take time for me. Sorry about that. Now we're going to do the EFF Track Crypto Awards, and I will turn this over to you, Mike.
All right, so we put together a crypto challenge. We had easy, medium, and hard levels. We had about 10 teams participating. Somebody read off winners for hard, medium, and easy levels. You can only win one award, so even though you may have competed in all three of the challenges, you'll get the award of the hardest challenge you've placed in. So it is, for the hard award, Super Team Awesome, are they here? Yay! So, coming up, first place with 130 points. Were you the one I was tweeting last night too?
Yes, hi.
We got prizes and shit. Get out of here.
You have to catch me when I was online.
So have you ever done anything like this before? You hold your booze.
Yeah, MIT does a thing every year in January, called Mystery Hunt, and it's just a whole bunch of puzzles, and you have a huge team, and you can solve all these puzzles, and then there's meta puzzles that you can solve as well. My friends are much better at it than I am, so.
No. You're here from MIT.
I graduated several years ago, so no.
Indirectly, eventually, at one point. Yay!
There you go. Second place, Power of Friendship. Are you here? They have 60 out of 130. And Fortify in third place? All right. Let's try medium. Freedom of Rock with 100 points out of 100. All right. Four Non-Blondes with 70 out of 100. Universe, third place. Easy Disambiguation. Bender is Great with 70 out of 100. And Subatomic Aura for third place.
Raise your hands. Where are those guys here?
They're not here. So,
oh, not here.
All right, for
first the pastors. All right, so we'll start the bidding at the rewards here at $50. This group. What is it, valid class? We don't care if it's yours.
Next question. So for you guys that enjoy playing with locks, I wanted to see what lock was the bane of your existence, or something you haven't cracked yet, or anything like that.
What should we buy?
Yeah. How deep are your pockets is the next question.
Yeah. That actually is the real question. Do you want a $1,000 padlock? That's a real question.
Sure. It's the locks are to slow people down. And that is the rating of locks and safes is basically the time it takes to break into them. And it's usually the money angle. And then the more money you spend, the longer it's going to take them to leave. So it's not the primary, it's the primary control, but you have to have a secondary control to detect and to give you time to respond and jump in and fix it up.
But yeah, I mean, there's plenty of locks I have to bypass. I'm a Cobra Methods of a entry instructor, so I teach
anyone with money. Not anyone with money. Basically, I teach them how to bypass or defeat a whole bunch of series of locks. There's tons of locks that I haven't defeated myself.
What are some of the different things that more robust locks implement that make them much more difficult to hit?
Things that make them more difficult to pick. Pins that require turning, not impossible to get past, like Medico. Plenty of people can pick Medico. I've picked a Medico before, but those pins that you have to turn, those make things more difficult. And you have to turn them because there's a thing called a sidebar in there, and that has to be in place and set before you can actually turn the actual cylinder so that the lock will unlock. Other things that make things more difficult you have in the back of the lock, you have a protection mechanism so you can't do simple bypasses. This is a Brinks lock. Brinks, they make great locks, just kidding, fucking suck. But there you go.
That's not a key he's holding for anyone in the back row. That's just a pick.
It's not even a pick, actually. It's just a bent piece of wire.
Is that a high security lock you're holding there, Drew?
So they market it as a high security lock. But it definitely is not. And it's not like one Brinks lock is vulnerable to that. It's like, oh, having some type of shielding in the back so you can't access the actual locking mechanism. Very unique key bidding. Two pairs of key bidding, so you'll have Primus. They have, if you look on a regular key, I don't have any regular keys with me. But you have the up and downs of the keys, right? And that's the bidding of the key. And what they'll have is a second layer of that on the side as well. So it's like you have to pick two different locks to get to that. Higher tolerances, that's the biggest thing. That's what lock picking is all about, is abusing tolerances. So locks from like Abloy and Asa, those locks will have higher tolerances. Like padlocks, they're padlocks that have great security. I travel, when I go to airports, I travel with my gun, so people can't then steal all the stuff that I have in my suitcase.
Yes.
So if you don't travel with a gun, you should travel with a gun.
They won't lose that bag.
Yeah, they will not lose that bag. Oh, and if they do, lots of people get fired. You get a few thousand dollars, or $2,000 to be exact. So do not be traveling with your super decked out, lock 34, 36, whatever, something like that costs $5,000, because they're not going to give you $5,000. Those type of things, I have the Abloy 330 padlocks, and excellent lock.
I've heard those are top.
Yeah, ones, so. But they cost $120 each. So, just higher tolerances, not being able to access the back of the lock.
Types of pins too, like serrations, stuff like that, types of pins, is that?
Yeah, the type of pin that you have with it. So you have security pins, which are spool pins, mushroom, serrated pins, stuff like that, sort of standard pins. But that's for picking. Remember, a lot of times you don't want to bother picking with a lock. What you want to do is just be able to. This lock has security pins, actually. It has serrated security pins. This lock is, it's not too difficult to pick, but it's fairly difficult. It's going to take you a few minutes, right? Or you can just spend 3 seconds with this, right? All the security pins in the world will not matter if you allow for poor design, which 80% of Brinks locks do. I can tell you, I don't like Brinks locks.
Thank you.
Bye. Yeah, so someone just asked about, on that same question, about the QuickSet Smart Key Locks. So I love QuickSet Smart Key Locks. Whenever I see that, I'm just like, oh god, yes. So I have a tool that you stick into the QuickSet, and you can buy this tool. It costs like, I think, like $350. Oh, thanks. And yeah, so it costs $350. You put it in there, and you can actually tell the bidding of the lock. So then you can get just go and make a key for that lock, right? And it doesn't require a whole bunch of skill to use that tool.
But so, to be clear, those QuickSet locks are not pickable.
The smart key ones are actually fairly difficult to pick, just because they're not like pin tumblers. They're kind of like wafer locks. But yeah, there's a, you don't need to pick them. Again, the best thing to do is not pick a lock. It's to just bypass it.
There's also a destructive entry tool that you can just plug in, oh, yes, take a wrench to, and then turn
it. Dustin, go to the mic if you want to ask a question. Dustin, go to the mic if you want to ask a question.
Thank you, ma'am.
You've been very patient.
Oh, no, okay. I was very interested. Okay, well, actually, that leads me to my, I have two serious questions, one non-serious. So I got a lockpick yesterday, and I was testing it out, and I figured out I don't have the bump that comes in, that's what it's called, apparently. So anyway, I was looking up, I was trying to go ahead and pick a lock somewhere.
That she had permission to pick.
That I had permission.
And that wasn't in use.
Right. And there was a tool that I was missing that was not in the little bundle that I got from you. And it's called a bump.
A 999 key.
Yes. Bunky. Yes.
Oh, bump keys. Yeah. So.
But I just wanted to know where I would find one. Other than Amazon or something like that.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, you can just go to the internet and look up bunkies, okay, stuff like that.
So the tool site that we pulled up earlier,
yeah,
also they sell their own kits and bump key sets, okay, and you can get them. And then to get lockpicking sets from experts as opposed to anything, mm-hmm, on Amazon, just is advice. Basically, people on Amazon, they are just, mass producing those, and they're very cheap.
That's what I thought. That's what I thought.
But you don't need a bump key to use the set that I gave to you last time. The rubber bands on these are used for bump keys, but there are no. And these rubber bands.
What else are they used for, Drew?
They're castration bands. Yeah, my wife has tons of them if you need any. But you don't need to use a bump key with this set, right? It has a single pin, just a hook, lock pick, and then a few tension wrenches in it. And that's all you need.
Back to the drawing board. Awesome. Secondly, so I'm usually in a social engineering role. However, I have gone more into more technical penetration testing. My question is, when you go, so you've compromised the machine, you've gone through the attack vector, you've set up your command and control, getting back out, so, and clearing your steps, are there any tools for that? Like, doing it myself, yes, I can. I know how to clear some usual spots that people look for, however, there's always something that I miss, so, and when I go back and do my own scans, is there any tools that like streamline it, or best tools?
I'm sure about tools. Also that, if you know their network well enough,
yep,
if you know that they're doing SSL decrypt, mm-hmm, or if they're not doing SSL decrypt, then you can just use HTTPS and just, send it out to your team. It'll just look like web traffic. And you can even use Chrome to do it, so it looks like Chrome is just, requesting this. And otherwise, there's lots of side channels. Social networking is one way to pull the stuff out.
So as a professional where your goal is to help educate your client,
right,
you might not necessarily want to scrub everything. So part of the purpose of the gig that you are on is to test their ability to identify what exactly happened. Can they run forensic response? Can they figure out they took this data out through this method? This is what was lost. This is what we need to address. Okay. That's a really big takeaway from a lot of pen tests. And I'll tell you right now, the answer is no, they can't do that. I don't know if I've ever seen an organization that has been able to do that to a mature point. One tool that I would direct you to that is pretty great is something called SOCAT. That's S-O-C-A-T. This thing is a Swiss Army knife of network traffic. Basically, it's fairly kind of like application layer agnostic. It enables you to establish TCP and UDP tunnels between various endpoints. And those tunnels can be over various protocols. So you can potentially be exfiltrating data over DNS. You can be doing it over ICMP. You can be doing it over all these various things. Honestly, though, if you're in a position where you're actually asking, holy smokes, how do I actually get data out of this environment? That's way, way, way better than the vast majority of organizations. Because I've seen plenty of organizations where their highly secured network allows HTTP outbound. Which is just okay. Well, that's garbage. That's terrible. Right. You can literally be in their most sensitive network segment and be browsing the open internet.
Okay, I have a third question, but I don't know.
You said
it's a non-serious question, so if it's really funny, go for it.
First question was the non-serious question. Okay.
Real quick.
With everything implemented in an environment, a network environment, I know that it depends on the environment. However, if you have, say, a network-based IPS in place, if you have host IDS, if you have a SIM where everything's logging, says logging to the SIM, and everything's working correctly, is there actually really a need for a network-based IDS? And what are the justifications for that? Because you know, then you're talking about cost versus what can you actually do that you're not already doing.
Yeah, so it's been about 10 years in IDS. I think, you know, just like we see, you know, the resurgence of macro viruses and MBR virus, it comes down to where can the hackers get in? And so, you know, protocol-based attacks are very low, right? So IDS, it was in there trying to figure out people doing funny stuff with with TCP/IP and doing protocol-based attacks. Its value is pretty low right now, but that doesn't mean that that it can't find something. I would rate it lower than I guess most of the other defensive technologies, and because you can also easily do IDS with by upgrading your routers and switches, right? You can buy that from Cisco or whoever you're using those.
Thank you.
So hi. At the beginning of the of this, you said that if I give you my password, that you'd give me a free lock.
Well, I have someone already in the queue for this. I haven't tried it yet.
Oh, really?
But if you also want to give me your password.
We'll make some sort of hacking setup and step it up.
So I was wondering, I have two-factor enabled on my Gmail accounts. I'm not actually going to give you my password because that would be stupid, but how much of a buffer does two-factor give me from if you knew my password?
Actually, a few days ago, I was on a gig where if anybody's ever used Duo Security before, I could not recommend them more highly. They are such a good product, it's such a good security control. It really does put a serious roadblock in the way of malicious third parties. That being said, I compromised a significant number of VPN accounts for this target, and I found out that their VPN was protected by two-factor authentication, specifically Duo. So I tried logging in with this account that I've compromised. I get to the page and it says, oh, we need to do your Duo two-factor whatever. And I was like,
fuck it, I'm gonna send a push notification to their phone. And they accepted it. And I'm like, I did the present twice. The first time it timed out, but the second time I sent it. Meanwhile, I'm actually in their email watching the whole incident response process like proceed. So I'm pretty sure they're on the phone with the people trying to reset their password, and they got the Duo push notification. They've accepted it. Oh, they're literally on the phone with support. So two-factor authentication is not, it does not solve all the problems, but it really, really does make things a lot more difficult. But let me ask you, is that the only place you use that password?
It is the only place I use that password, yes.
Okay, well, great. You are one of very few. It might, in that case, yeah, we wouldn't be able to pop it just because we know the credentials, but if you use that anywhere else, well, we can very quickly find out where those credentials are useful for.
And just talking about having two-factor and the capability of using it on your phone, I believe it's NIST no longer recommends using two-factor on your phone. And that's because cell phones are easy to pop. The person sitting in front of me is like the testament of that. That kind of, you guys didn't know that. But yeah, so having two-factor on your phone is no longer a recommended best practice.
And I would add too, I just read recently, I watched a popular YouTuber get, he had his entire Gmail account stolen with two-factor off, because what someone did as a social engineer, they went into the cell phone carrier store, just a box shop, said, oh, I'm so-and-so, I'm Drew Porter, and I lost my SIM card, I need to get another one. So they said, sure, dip out, here you go, put it in his phone, and then sent the two-factor, and he got the notification, said, yep, that's me, and all of a sudden, boom, and the YouTuber got a notification that his phone was dead. He was using his phone, all of a sudden everything quit working because his SIM was invalid anymore. So that was a cool way to social engineer kind of your way around two-factor as well on your cell phone.
So I highly recommend going out to a shop and saying that your name is Drew Porter and ask
them. Especially AT&T, yeah.
So the mitigation to that is that they won't tell you, but most of the T-Mobile and AT&T, you call, put a password on your account that, you know, that if anybody's going to change anything important, you have a password, a password.
He had that too. Yeah, and the representatives ignored it. They didn't care. They're just, you know, they're just in the box.
Another layer of protection.
Bullshit work.
Everyone in here should call their, you know, do that so that nobody can.
And so I could be wrong, but I believe the format of two-factor authentication that was deprecated by NIST was not necessarily using two-factor auth on your phone, but relying on a text message for two-factor auth. So you receive a text message with a PIN number in it, you enter that PIN number into the website, you're now given access. This same attack, where if they had gotten another SIM card and then provisioned the phone underneath that, underneath that person's account, if you were using something like Duo, that still wouldn't matter because you need to install the application on the phone, have the proper access controls and authority to do so, and then go from there. So I believe the method that was deprecated was solely if your version of two-factor auth is we're gonna send a text message to your phone number and you accept and you take the data within that and go from there, that is no longer considered a secure method of two-factor authentication.
Okay.
So, I really to pull off of that story, I had kind of a dark, story around that type of fraud, right? So, it's fairly prevalent now. It was kind of new, about a decade ago, but that general fraudsters, identity thefts are doing this nowadays. And so, again, call your provider, put a password on your account. It may provide a little bit of help. But the story was is that an elderly couple had their phone stolen in a similar manner. Injury occurred in which they were not able to call 911, sorry, and perished. And so, it was very, there's very few times where you can, attach computer security to human lives and fraud to human lives, and that, just brings it home that, yes, losing your Google account is one thing, but sometimes, the attackers have unintended consequences, and it's just good to remember.
So,
just trying to bring it together from what you guys are saying, advice to the audience is, if they're going to use two-factor authentication, say on a Google account, what is the best kind of use?
Duo two-factor authentication, hands down, no questions asked.
I follow that up again.
Duo.
Is Duo paying us here?
No. It's literally not even paid for. It's one of the most frustrating security controls that I've ever encountered as an offensive security professional.
I know the CTO of the company, and it's just that they know their shit, and they're great to work with.
Okay, so you said that I had to give you a password for my email.
I have to be able to log into your account. I have to get your password and log into your account.
You only have to accept
one two-factor.
So can I get like give you a password to an email that I don't check and that's like the only password that I use?
Is it the
Why
one?
Why would you be asking this? No,
right,
you
right, no, never confess.
Was not did I not say like an icon?
No, you just said password. You just said password for an email.
You guys are gonna watch this video again and you'll be like, oh fuck, that Ginger was right. It was Gmail or iCloud, and I have to be able to log in.
I think it would be more entertaining if the two of you wrestled.
What was the audience said?
Wrestling.
Thinking you take him?
No.
Next question.
This going back to regular lock picking. I was just wondering, so what lock pick set do you use?
Oh, that's a great question. I have it here. Where my tools people? This guy's still using it. Okay. The set that I use is actually one that is not like standard purchase. I just bought it piece by piece. But the picks that I use, I have two picks, three types of rakes. So the picks are Peterson picks. I love Peterson picks. They don't pay me to say that. They do cost a little bit more than all the other picks, but they've lasted the longest for me. So the purple handle ones are 18/1000ths of an inch thick. They're the thinner ones, but they're not super thin. They do make a 15/1000ths, but you don't need that. You do in some cases, but I don't usually need that when running into like American locks. And then this one is 0.025 of an inch. And it's Peterson. It's a hook number one, and this is also a hook number one. They cost $8 each. Then I have a wave rake that's made by Tool. It is supposed to be mathematically one of the perfect designs for a wave rake, and it is. I've been to the person who developed this lock pick wave rake, and she's extremely, extremely smart, and her math checked out on it.
I saw that presentation PowerPoint a couple months ago. That's great.
Similar to the picks, I have Bogotas by Peterson again, and they're just the Bogota ones. But the thing that I have most of in my kit that I carry is tension wrenches, because that's what you really care about when you're picking locks. Because you need a whole bunch of wide array of tension wrenches for different types of locks. So Tool makes a set called the Tension 6. It's 6 different tension wrenches. I have that in there. Sparrow makes a set for tension wrenches. They have cone picks on one side, and their top of the keyway on the other side, and then one has what they call the Mantis, which is for tubular lockpick picking. The ones that I use quite a bit are by Peterson, and they're the top of the keyway tension tools, and 0.4 and 0.5, 0.04 and 0.05 thickness, and then I haven't bent this one particularly for the shape of my finger, how I like the lockpick. So customizing your lockpicks is definitely something that you should do, and then just two standard ones I think I got from lockpick.org for tension wrenches. And then a series of bypass tools as well. But yeah, that's it. And the whole set with the bypass tools cost, I don't know, about $150. And the case is a, I forget what case it is, but it's from Sparrows. And I carry it with me all the time. When I do physical pen testing, rarely do I do lockpicking. Usually it's bypasses. So I just carry around because sometimes I get bored in meetings and I like lockpicking. And they can't see me on the other side of the WebEx, so.
The part of my set includes also the top of a BIC pin, and just and also a cutout of an aluminum can for padlocks.
Okay, like the shark tooth method, or?
Yeah, basically to insert along this edge or this edge to be able to.
Yeah, you kind of turn it and kind of twist it in.
I think it's on the shims.
Yeah.
And you can make your own shims or buy them. It's,
All right. And then one other quick question: Have you heard the Really Man lockpick card?
Yeah. So someone, I feel so bad. Kevin Mitnick has like a lockpick card, right?
Yeah. All right. That's it.
Yeah, so that is definitely a thing that can happen. Or not, that can happen, sorry. I was just thinking what he was saying. There's a few people with business cards that have lockpicks in it. It's pretty cool.
All right, thank you.
Yep.
All right, so my question is more a little bit back on social engineering and kind of initially getting in. So I'm just interested to hear, do you guys find that kind of most of the, am I close up? Most of the mistakes that lead to being able to get into a network, are those coming from the end users helpfully accepting a push notification? Or is a lot of that coming from like a system administrator or a developer who really just doesn't care and has made some kind of colossal mistake and left a big opening for you guys?
So it's not even that they don't care.
They just don't know.
So even as security practitioners, it is difficult to write secure software. It is very difficult to write secure software. Security at its core is not an easy concept to grasp just because it's always an adversarial problem. It's an armor. It's not like, oh, well, once you get this good, all your shit's gonna be secure. It's that you have legitimate malicious third parties. You have organized crime, which is funneling massive amounts of money into this whole industry where they're literally doing illegal things to profit. That's who you're up against. That is your adversary. So security is not easy. Every single developer that I have met, if they could write secure software out of the box, they would. It's just, as somebody that has written a software platform that is 50,000 lines of Python and 20,000 lines of JavaScript by myself, I can still attest to the fact that even after years of doing this professionally, it is not easy to write secure software at all.
And yeah, I feel like going to end users is kind of like the get out of jail free card. Like, I can always get by social engineering. I mean, that's always a weak spot. And if you're doing a professional pen test, that doesn't necessarily help the people that are paying you, right? You're there to show them how they can help improve their system. And if they just have, an employee that you've tricked, that doesn't necessarily to help. We still use it as part of it to show the demonstration of, this technical control that you paid $15 million for is overcome by a secretary that, just gave you access. And so that's the place for that in the professional pen test.
Thank you.
So the story about the two-factor authentication that was overcome by the SIM card, the helpful cell phone salesman. It occurred to me, in the movies, some good or bad guy clones the phone and suddenly has all his text messages. Can more than one phone be on the cellular network? And if your phone has been cloned, do weird things happen, and what does that look like?
You just get shut down. I mean, it's the new SIM card gets issued. They say the old SIM card is invalid, and you basically get the message that SIM card invalid.
Right, but if it's done a different way, if
yeah, you're right. So cellular networks, I love breaking them. Yeah. So what happens when you get a new SIM card? You get a SIM card has a digit, a 15-character digit on it, called the IMSI on it, right? And that's an International Mobile Subscriber ID. And with that, it gets registered in what's called an HLR, Home Location Registry. It's on the back-end network of the cellular network, right? And your home location registry is used within other parts to verify that you can actually be on that cellular network. Now, let's say you somehow clone a SIM card to where you can have two SIMs that have the exact same IMSI, which has happened to me before. My card didn't get cloned. AT&T sent my research lab that I was running at the time SIM cards that somehow had the same IMSI, and I got a panic phone call, and they're like, please do not put that in any phones. And I was just like, I mean,
whoops.
Yeah. Sure. I will make sure I don't do that, but my intern will. What happens? Xavier was correct in saying that your phone will get shut down. And if they technically have two SIMs with the exact same IMSI on them, they will both get shut down at the same time. Now, are there things that can happen to where that will not happen? The answer is yes. So for the HLR, you have what's also called a VLR. And a VLR is a visitor location registry. Now, the HLR and the VLR are supposed to communicate. And when you're at a VLR, so let's say I'm in, Phoenix, Arizona, right? My HLR is not in Phoenix, Arizona. But when I'm there, I'm on some type of VLR. Now, it's supposed to communicate back to my HLR and say, hey, like, this is cell phone, like, everything, check out. And then you can, use the cellular network. It doesn't always do that sometimes, and there's a few failover methods that allow you to be temporary on the cellular network, sort of in like a, we'll let them on, and it's working. There are other checks that it does. Besides that, so it's not just like you're gonna pop in a random SIM card and it's gonna work for a few hours on a cellular network. But there are fail conditions where you can be communicating with two different phones on the same SIM card, or the same SIM IMSI, with two different hardware IDs, and things could work. Those are very rare instances, instances to be very difficult to prove, to make it extremely repeatable. Things that can be more repeatable is, let's say your cell phone gets stolen, sort of along the same lines of that last, like confusing the location registries and stuff like that. Your cell phone gets stolen and you say that, like, hey, my cell phone was stolen. That IMEI, your hardware ID for that phone, gets told to a system called the AUE, which I'm drawing a blank on what that stands for, authentication equipment, something. That's capital A, lowercase u, capital E is how they do that. And if you go to some place like the Philippines, and I use that as a very direct example, your phone, the phone that was marked as stolen, which should work on any cellular network now, will now start working because those networks are not communicating with each other, or they're not sharing that information. So
the same in South Korea.
South Korea. Is it possible? Definitely. What happens in 99.999, almost going to infinity cases, is it's going to be both of them get shut down at the same time.
if you didn't want that to happen, then you basically are looking at, instead of trying to clone a phone, hack their phone. That's the attack method, right? You know, it's, if you want, you know, to sneak on their SMS, but you don't want to shut down their phone, that's the attack method.
The thing that I was trying to figure out is, if someone had been able to do that to, say, my phone, what would that look like? Would, like, I start receiving only half of my text messages, or?
No, because if you receive half your text messages, that means you still have active communication to the network, and that the network is communicating happily with that phone. And for that to happen, transversal network communication, it would mean that all parts are working. What would happen is both phones would receive the same text message, which usually when that happens, that's what trips the, hey, there are now two phones with this same IMSI on the network. We need to shut them both down because it's a security problem. So either one phone will continually accept the text messages, and the other phone won't be getting them because there's that network break for whatever reason, or both phones get like one text message and then they both stop working.
Thank you.
Yep.
Good evening. It used to be a common practice for aspiring hackers and penetration testers to build a test network. That way they would have servers and networks that they could play around on and experiment with.
Or you can use your neighbors.
Or you can use
Don't do that.
Do you have any thoughts on how somebody would do this to practice social engineering?
Oh, don't do that.
It's a very, yes, actually I do. So when I worked for another consulting company, I used to have this offer for people, and I no longer have this offer just because I'm really busy with other client work, unfortunately, where Friday nights, if you wanted to go like hack some people, we would go to a bar and we would pump people for information. And God, people are so easy to pump for information. So this is when I lived in the Phoenix area, and I knew where all the DoD contractors for different types of companies would go drink on Friday nights. So then you go pump them for information. Also, it's very helpful if you know the type of preference that person that you're trying to target, or the group of people that you're trying to target. If it's a whole bunch of male engineers, good case, they might like pretty females. Some cases, they might like males. I'm not a male that other gay males seem to like. not that I've really tried, I just have gay friends and be like, oh, yeah, good thing women like you, Drew. you can definitely go to bars and you can practice on those people and try to pump them for information. Do it in the elevator, right? You run into someone that's not in this room. Because now no one's going to fall for this in this room, hopefully. And you're just like, oh my gosh, where do you work? Or look at you, you're dressed as Slytherin. That means, you know, you're going to give me all your information, but that you're smarter than me or something. You can just, what you do is you start connecting to them on some type of level. Do it everywhere, anywhere. In the Starbucks line, at a bar, when you're meeting with someone new at work that you don't know, you pump them for information too. There is that case. There is a test bed for that, and it's normal human interaction, but targeted to where you're like, I want to try to get XYZ pieces of information out of people.
Then the other flip side of that is trying to convince somebody of your story. And so, the whole, kind of cliche dating thing where, I'm an astronaut, and that's coming up with a backstory and here's what I'm doing. Just when you're meeting people randomly, like in Starbucks, try something out and just go with it, and they look at you weird, and then you try again, and you get that comfort level of sounding like you know what you're talking about, and then you end up on a panel in Hacker 2.
That brings us to the next.
Okay, I had an idea that maybe we'll even do a beta test tonight, but for next year, maybe, you know, we've got elevators and R's here, so perhaps we should do a social engineering field trip / scavenger hunt. More points for us.
We have a panelist on Hacker 101 who's now sitting in the crowd. But she is an excellent person to talk about social engineering problems. And if she wants to, she can raise her hand and you can then discuss things.
There you go. You just got social engineering.
She really is an astronaut.
She's a great person to talk about with dealing with social engineering questions that you have. I used to work with her, and she was extremely, extremely deceptive against clients that paid her to be deceptive against their employees. Hit her up and ask her all your social engineering questions.
Has anyone social engineered their way into DragonCon today?
That's pretty cool.
Security!
It's a trap. It's a trap, people. Awesome.
What's up?
Yeah. So password managers, do you believe in them? What's your personal preference, if you have one? And what's your favorite to see in the wild?
Notepad.
I don't know what one of my favorite security professionals would recommend. Notepad++.
Yeah, you want to do is you want to save it in your My Documents directory under passwords.txt. That's usually the first place I look for.
That's where I put my porn.
Yeah.
Every single time I look for passwords there, yeah. No, but to really answer your question, yes, I believe in password managers because I have a terrible memory. So much so that I almost forgot your question right there. No, it was password managers that I like. KeePass is what I really like. I'm still part of the group that's like super paranoid and like doesn't like doing password managers through my web browser or anything like that. But there are plenty of people who tell me that that works great, and you know, plenty of people way smarter than me that are like, yeah, I do that every single day. But I use KeePass, and I love KeePass. It makes everything simple, and it works on all the operating systems that I care about. I think there's one called XKeePass that works on Linux.
LastPass for me. That's what.
LastPass. Yeah. There's no password manager that I'm aware of that has not been compromised thus far. Like basically, I mean, LastPass was, there was recently an exploit published by a very intelligent guy over at Google, Tavis, that basically remote exploit against your browser could pull all of the credentials out of LastPass for you. There's also a Metasploit module that will pull all the data out of KeePass if you pop somebody's box and you run those modules on the box. So password managers are absolutely critical. You should definitely be using them. I use LastPass personally. I use two-factor around it, and then I use two-factor on all of the accounts that I actually care about in addition to having a very strong password. There are potential downsides to having a single point of failure where if your password manager gets popped, they have all of your passwords in it. But when you put that side by side with the problem of password reuse that you will see the vast majority of people run into otherwise, of like, oh, well, you know, I can't remember 500 different passwords, so I'm just going to use the same password across every single one of these accounts. Well, chances are at least one of those accounts has been compromised already, and if that password can be reused against other services, then really you're in no better place than using a password manager that's been compromised before as well. So use LastPass, use two-factor. Well, use any password management system. I like LastPass. But use two-factor around anything you really care about and don't want anybody to get into otherwise.
I think I found a website, I'm trying to remember the name of it, basically it was something like two-factor.org or something, where they just listed out the web services that actually provide two-factor as part of, Google and Facebook, and then the ones that, so that you can know if you're going to go and use, you want a cloud service that uses two-factor, and you can go find it.
And if anyone wants to give us their LastPass username and password, you get a free lockpick set.
Yep.
I'll give you my one pass.
The size of the lockpick set is dwindling. I think we're down to one pick at a time.
Yeah, last pass is worth it.
I got a couple of USB sticks.
As just kind of an aside, I would say two-factor authentication plus the ability to prevent lateral movement within a network, which is what Xavier's company actually works on, as well as being able to determine what your exposure on your network is. If you have all three of those in place, we could potentially start beating the problems that are the reason we see these massive breaches today. So two-factor authentication and password managers are a critical component of pushing the agenda forward within the security community.
In regards to the what you were talking about, Drew, earlier about the SIM card exploit involved, is there anything that's between CDMA, like a Sprint phone, things like that, or a network that uses a SIM card, is there anyone that's innately insecure, or?
Yes. So a lot of people think CDMA, and I'm just going to say this is wrong, is more secure because, you know, there's more people hacking GSM.
What is CDMA?
Yeah, that's great. It's code.
Code division multiple access.
Yeah, there you go. Someone memorize all their silly.
It's the other one that's not GSM, though.
Yeah. That's because they're like, oh, rogue access points, blah, 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 blah. Or rogue, base station or stuff like that. So is it any more secure? The answer is it is not any more secure or less secure than GSM because we have the great thing called 3G and 4G technologies, which make it increasingly difficult. And when I say increasingly difficult, without doing another step, which is actually like, I don't remember how many steps it is, 1-5, but less than 10 steps. You can intercept any of their signal, but it's all gonna be encrypted, and you're not gonna break that right now. So is it more secure or less secure? The answer is no, they're both terribly insecure because they both connect to a terribly secure, insecure network. If I want to listen to your what's classified as GSM or your LTE, which falls under GSM, you know, that family with 3GPP and all that stuff. Or if I want to listen to your WCDMA signal, which is a 3G technology, what I do is I break into the cellular network first, and then I do some magic with SS7, which is their control protocol, out-of-band control protocol, which replaced C5. And which, if they have an IP-based network, you can do like SIGTRAN and start asking for keys and stuff like that.
They use SIP that, now.
Huh?
They've all switched to SIP for a
while. SIP? Oh,
yeah,
so.
Sorry, they gave up.
Yeah, so.
That's
so,
a 7, like 10 years ago.
Well, SIP is super secure, so that's great.
You may have just made your day.
No, SS7 is still used on cellular networks for control protocols. I know this just because a few years ago I developed technologies to abuse cellular networks and it used SS7 within this method, and then the government bought that method and it seemed to work for them for a while. But everything's moving away from these older RK9 technologies. It's everything's insecure in cellular. Don't trust it. But yeah, hopefully that answered your question.
Before we take the next question, I just wanted to let y'all know it's midnight. If anyone's got somewhere else they've got to be, well, there you go, midnight. We were thinking about breaking and then reconvening in the EFF trap room on the second floor at 12:30, but we'll go ahead and take the next several questions. And at this point, I'm basically waiting for the pizza is here call, and as soon as I get it, I guess it'll be a mad rush for the exit.
10 minutes?
Okay, yeah, that's enough. We'll take the next three questions, then we'll break and meet up in the EFF track room. It's not open right now, so if you go up there, the doors are locked. So.
Giving out lockpicks?
I wasn't going to mention that, but. Gentlemen, let's go ahead and ask your
questions now.
So more of a professional question. When defacing a website, is it kind of uncouth or unprofessional to use like personal dick pics? Should you outsource dick pics?
There's a great site that provides a number of dick pics called meatspin.com. So anytime you're defacing a website, I highly recommend referencing that as a source.
I prefer Skydildo, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's to each their own, but, you know, really, as far as the professionals are concerned, meatspin.com is the
way to go. I feel like you have to reach back to the basics and some of the old, you know, pictures that occurred in the 90s.
Goatsy
is just, you gotta respect the class.
Don't Google that. Don't.
Tough girl.
So you mentioned several bad practices for passwords, storing them in plain text file, password reuse, trying to borrow your password for a lockpick set, things like that. Which of those is the worst culprit, in your opinion?
I have kind of a weird one for you. So bad development is one, actually. So we were given a mobile test, a mobile app. It was so secure that it used voice recognition to log into the app. So you take your phone, you say, my name is Ray, something that you recorded before, and it would let you into the app. And it worked really well. No one else could use it, worked perfect. So what we did, we took the app, we used it, and our pen tester was looking through the file system because it was jailbroken. And we looked, and the tester found a random file that made no sense. It was just like, you know, irock.xyz in the file system. Like, what is that? So let me dump it into an editor and let's just see what's in it. And it would all look like garbage, complete garbage, except at the very top, he saw text in there that said things like album, title, genre.
Oh, no.
Anyone?
Oh, it was an audio file.
It was an MP3. Oh. So what he did was took the file, drug it off, put it on his computer, renamed it to MP3, hit play with his device there, and it logged him into the phone.
Oh.
And into the app. So trying to use, you know, security through obscurity, right? You know, like, oh, I'm going to rename this file. No one's ever going to figure that out. So I'll just add that bad development practices is, that's one of my favorites, to look for those types of things.
Yeah, I mean, there's several, you know, you look at the threat horizon, you know, what are you worried about, right? What are you protecting, and so what kind of controls would you put in place? With the mass hacking that's occurring, you know, there's the fact that, you know, that's where I would lean toward password reuse. And the fact that, you know, if I use this, you know, one account, this one password in Dropbox that just got popped, Now, that password is going to be used for, you know, people are going to be trying to log in, including things like tax returns.
Drew, I guess this question is going to be good for you. I apologize because you've seen the one that everyone's questioning this evening. You were bringing up the SS7 vulnerabilities earlier. I was under the impression you needed access to the base station for those vulnerabilities. Would you be able to go into a little bit more detail of that? And I know we're all pretty much at the mercy of cellular carriers as far as like actually needing them. What can we do to cover our butts, if any?
Drew, it's total bullshit that you don't attract guys.
You've gotten all the attention tonight.
So you need special access, and there are a few methods which I've developed to get you particular access to what you need to install your networks. Unfortunately, I cannot discuss those in detail, not just for the security of the cellular network providers, but because that research has been, you know, bought and paid for, and I can't go into any extreme detail.
Understood.
I really wish I could, though. it is a interesting thing. But if you want to learn how to get particular access on this, there are people that have given talks covering these types of technologies and ways to get these types of access before online. CCC usually has a whole bunch of talks about cellular. A lot of smart people, way smarter than me, give talks there.
about cellular networks and insecurities on those particular cellular networks.
Thank you.
So let's say each of you guys bought a new laptop that's got Windows 10 on it. What would you do to harden it to protect yourselves from people like you?
Windows 10. You know, there was a question in 101 that they basically asked, like, what OS are we using? Kind of, you know, that is, you know, what secure, like, super elite thing we're doing. And we all kind of went down the panel and said, Windows 10. And it's because, you know, it's you know, the corporate lack of love. You know, and so in saying that, you know, it's keeping things up to date. I was a little bit more worried about privacy than security on Windows 10. So there's some really good, you know, you can Google around and find some good checklists on how to minimize the amount of data that goes to Microsoft. I wouldn't be too paranoid about it. You know, there's certain things that are really bad, like the Wi-Fi password sharing. But that the other stuff is generally just telemetry, because I, you know, have a company that makes software and we want to get the same kind of telemetry. I have a little bit of soft spot for that, but in general, you know, it's as long as you're using the most up to date, you know, version, and then, you know, it's kind of like the necessary. Definitely on Windows 10.
Yeah. So, what are you trying to protect from? Like, telemetry data being sent out. So, like, what thing we were talking about?
Yeah. There's a lot of telemetry sent, but one of the things I do is I put like CentOS in a virtual machine, and then do all my internet access through.
Get close to the mic.
Oh, sorry. One of the things I do is I put CentOS into a virtual machine, and then use that to get the internet. So.
A lot of people, you know, we bash on antivirus for not working because a lot of antivirus doesn't work. But antivirus works as like a stupid protector, right? So when you're like late at night and you're gaming and then you're drinking a whole bunch and then you forget like security best practices and you click on a random link that you got from an email from a friend that you like haven't talked to in a billion years, and that antivirus pops up. It's just like, hey, we quarantined this problem that happened. It's great. At the same time, having your system, trying to do a pen test against your system, right? So set it up with all the tools and stuff that you use, and start using them, and then start scanning your network and seeing what your system gives out. You might be surprised that your CAD development software actually sets up an FTP server on your system as well, and stuff like that. So, you know, do some type of pen test against it if you have that capability, or if you know someone that has that capability for you, stuff like that. Those are the two recommendations.
Yeah, and just to add on to what Drew was saying, the first thing I would do if given a Windows 10 machine is take it back to the store and have a device with OSX. And I know
they don't collect to
disagree with me quite a bit, but in all seriousness, it's very difficult to protect yourself. Even as folks that do this stuff day in, day out, we're passionate about this, this is what we enjoy doing, it's difficult to protect yourself. If you are legitimately concerned about, you know, you want to make sure that your banking information is safe, you want to make sure that, you know, this information is safe, that information is safe, the strongest thing that I can recommend is have a separate physical device.
Yeah.
That you only, basically, you don't log into any of the stuff that you really care about on anything but this device in particular. And then the other device, go nuts with it. Do whatever you want with it. You haven't touched anything you care about with it. You don't have your password manager on it. If it gets compromised, it's not a big deal. Anything like that. But the folks that I hold in very high regard, they all have separate physical systems that they use to interact with services that they very much don't want to be compromised.
And that's actually my number one recommendation when I'm working with small businesses, is that, you know, that they can't really keep up with that. They don't, you know, they're just struggling by
and they all budget for lots of stuff. So, you know, do your, you know, accounting and do your reporting stuff on a machine that sits there and only does that stuff. And then, you know, don't surf the web, don't do, you know, so that's a very good recommendation.
So there's some good VMs to do pen testing with, do you recommend those?
VMs to do pen testing with, or
intrusion platforms? Detection
Let's expand on this in the later part of 201, because we've got two more people after you, and we'll probably get me out of here very quickly. Oh, three more people. I just wanted to kind of group real quick. I've never really messed with lock picking before at all, and I just popped my first lock three times in a row within about 3 seconds. It's a Brinks lock. So,
No. That's a Brinks lock.
It's a great high security lock. This is the first time I've ever messed with lock picking and locks, and I popped this thing with like nothing, and then did it twice more just to make sure that wasn't a fluke. So
that's a standard security lock for Brinks.
I'm terrified now.
I like bagging on Brinks, but when they market things as standard security, I'll let people know. But yeah,
that mean 3 seconds or 5 seconds?
Yeah. It means that it still has a bypass. Even their high security and max security locks have bypasses.
And let this be kind of a lesson to any of the folks out there that are not particularly involved in the security industry thus far. I remember the first time that I ever tried picking a lock, I was pretty intimidated. And I was like, oh man, this must be difficult. This must be, I have no idea how this works. 5 minutes later, I had popped all of the locks that were sitting on the table and was just aghast by the fact that it was so easy. I bought my first lock pick set that day. When I returned from the conference that evening, I picked all of the locks on my townhome within 20 minutes. It was very unsettling. A lot of these things that we're talking about will seem like they might potentially be out of reach, that will take a little bit of effort, that they might be, you know, beyond the depth of knowledge that you have presently, but don't let that scare you. It's actually, in a lot of cases, this easy to get started is just try it. And you'll see that things fail open, you'll see that they break very easily, and once you get that initial taste under your belt, that'll be, oh, that sounds terrible. Once you get that initial exposure, you'll find that it's pretty easy to keep going from there.
I'm a fucking moron, if I can do this.
And not so many words that.
Hey, so, you know, one of the things is, you know, security is to protect your assets, right? Not that I have any really worth stealing off my computer, but I guess it becomes a nuisance. But when you think about securing your assets, what's your thoughts around encryption of your assets and then things coming along like blockchain that can really sort of reinvent security on the enterprise level from the asset perspective? And then you're not worried about perimeter security, because I think, you know, that's like having gold stacked in your living room. Someone's always going to get through your house. How do you secure the gold?
There is no point at which you should not care about perimeter security. Encryption, blockchain, all of these things, that's great and all, but as soon as I get the key, your encryption's out the window. So,
but you're never going to get the key because it's blockchain.
How so? Can you explain that?
Are you familiar with blockchain?
How it works? Not as much as I should be.
Oh, no, I think you, okay, no, that's why I was asking what, because
if you, if
pretty
if
familiar
you,
with it,
if
it's
you
a
as
non,
a legitimate user, if you a, as a legitimate user have access, then all I need to do is compromise your credentials.
Right. But you're never going to get it because there's never a third party involved.
But if you have access to that data, I only need to compromise your authority.
Is anybody here really up to speed on blockchain?
Yes.
Yeah, maybe you could come up and who said that? Maybe we can talk about it upstairs.
Put it this way, if you can access it and I can gain your authority, so can I. If you have the ability to access it and I can gain your authority, so can I.
This sounds like a greater detail question.
I think so,
but,
thanks.
But you should encrypt everything at rest.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dual disencryption, definitely
no problem.
That.
You two, and then we're going to take the official break, kind of leave, because the tech guys in here have got a morning plan to go and throw our asses out. We don't want to delay their party.
So you want to take over the entire internet? The answer used to be really easy, BGMP. Does that still work today, or how would you take over the internet?
Well, how do I take
If you want to take over the whole internet, the answer used to be that's easy, BGMP.
Well, I...
But today, what would you do?
Pictures of cats. That is an interesting question, and one that requires more time than what we have. But if you're going to be hanging out afterwards, we can talk about world domination and taking over the internet.
Drew's approach is to do so with a security consultancy.
Yeah.
Okay, so I can't really follow that question, but I've been wondering, I've been reading a few news articles, like, so security, you know, you define kind of a baseline of trust, and you work up from that, and, you know, I was reading some articles about Intel's, the management interface, you know, an actual processor running, aside from your, you know, what you probably see as the processor, and it has the offline suites and all that. And, you know, that kind of interferes with my idea of, well, you assume the CPU's trusted, right? So what do you guys think about that? And
yeah, there are those kind of like sub-processing systems. I saw a good one on, you know, hacking via HDMI. You know, that you know, TVs and their on-screen display has their own, you know, logic, and their own little mini computer inside that you can hack and do some very interesting stuff with. You know, it's those type of things that, you know, when you say, you know, what do we do with Windows 10? You know, it's like, fuck, we're gonna get attacked, you know, hacked at one point. You know, it's that, you know, following best practices and being able to kind of, you know, have a model in which you know, do, you know, that risk assessment, that, you know, threat assessment that says, you know, what do I care about, and what am I gonna put my effort into? Then you know, that's your, you know, the security company I will create one that is the good enough security company org. And it's basically getting to the point where, you know, you feel, you know, you're secure enough. And there's still gonna be ways of hacking, and that you gotta have a way of responding to that. And if you think that, you know, the idea is to come up with all these ways to defend yourself, then you're missing it. The idea is not only to, you know, come up with ways to defend yourself, but also what happens when my, you know, credit card number gets stolen. You know, you call up and you get it reset. And so that's the type of like instant response you need to know, not only, you know, that you can protect some things, but also know that you're not the smartest person in the world. Somebody's going to get past it, and what do you do when that happens? So,
yeah, going back directly to processors, microcode hacking. I don't really do a whole bunch of it, but I pay someone else to do a whole bunch of it. He does work with me. Yeah, the guy is a freaking genius, and it just goes to show that you know, we're trying to secure our networks and our systems from a very high level. We're going down lower and lower and lower, right? Having hardware hacking part of a normal pen test was not really heard of 10 years ago, but now there's plenty of pen tests that I get put on by clients, and they want to integrate hardware into it now, right? Well, now that we've gone and better secured, or hopefully better secured, the physical hardware stuff, what are we going to start attacking? And now they're attacking code within processors. Which is just amazing, because it's just like all these vulnerabilities that we had to worry about, we still have to worry about, and now we have to worry about a shit ton more, which require people that are like way more brilliant than I will ever be to be able to attack and hack and securing that. one of the quotes from this guy, and he's an interesting character, very smart person, but he said, dealing with microcode and processors, I will always have a job, and I will always be able to demand the pay that I want with it. And I said, you are correct, and here's your paycheck.
So just to add one last thing to that, you're kind of getting at an issue here, which is kind of a fundamental, in a lot of cases, misunderstanding about security. There is no such thing as security. I'm sorry, I wish that I could say that you can do X, Y, Z and be secure, you can
can do this, you can be secure, but at the end of the day, there's threat modeling, there's who do you actually care about that you don't want to compromise your stuff, and then build your defensive protocols around that, because the fact of the matter is, x86, the whole instruction set, the chips that are being built, I mean, we even have evidence that some of the intelligence agencies are intercepting devices when they're en route to places that they're being delivered to, and they're being modified on the hardware level. I mean, we're talking, you need to have skilled hardware engineers to even be able to tell you that there might be something wrong. So, of all the things that you can potentially trust, one of the only things that I would actually throw that trust behind is encryption. We're talking about some of the most intelligent mathematical theoreticians to ever have lived that are designing protocols that are pretty much mathematically sound and say, look, if you do this, if you follow these very specific steps, there's no way that somebody that does not have access to a key is going to have access to the data. One of the only foundations in security that you can rely upon that even the three-letter organizations have trouble with is encryption.
Thank you, panelists. We're going to take a break. The EFF track room is upstairs. It's room 208, 209.